Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Environmental Protection Agency recently designated two so-called forever chemicals as hazardous substances. These are synthetic molecules that have been around since the 1940s, used in cookware, carpets, clothing, firefighting foams. And for many, these chemicals are in their drinking water, where there is compelling evidence that they can cause cancer, birth defects, and organ failure. Many are celebrating this move by the EPA. This is something that they say will save lives. And there is much credit to be given to Robert Bilott. He is an attorney who took on DuPont about its dumping and cover-up of these chemicals in West Virginia. The story is told in the 2019 film Dark Waters, starring Mark Ruffalo as Bilott.
There is a man-made chemical. It was invented during the Manhattan Project. It repelled the elements, especially water. So they used it to make the first ever waterproof coating for tanks. It was indestructible. Then some companies thought, hey, why just a battlefield? Why not bring this chemical into American homes? DuPont was one of those companies. So they took this chemical, PFOA, they renamed it C8, and they made their own impenetrable coating, but not for tanks, for pans. They called it Teflon, a shining symbol of American ingenuity made right here in the USA in Parkersburg, West Virginia. But right from the start, something wasn't right. The men and workers who made Teflon were coming down with nausea, fevers. DuPont wanted to know why. So they laced cigarettes with Teflon. They told a group of the workers, hey, smoke these. DuPonters did as they were told. Almost all those men were hospitalized.
That's 1962, 1 year after Teflon launched, and already DuPont knew. The dust, they just sent right up the smokestacks, released into the air. The sludge, tossed it into the Ohio, or packed it into drums and chucked it into the Chesapeake. But then the drums started washing up. So DuPont starts digging ditches on the grounds of the Washington Works plant, and in those pits, they dumped thousands of tons of toxic C8 sludge and dust. One of the men that they hired to dig those ditches was Wilbur Tennant's brother, Jim. But they weren't the only ones covering their tracks. 3M, who pioneered these chemicals for Scotchgard, they were testing them on monkeys. Most of the monkeys died. It wasn't like DuPont didn't know that, because they were doing their own tests on rats. Watched their organs balloon. Now the rats are getting cancers. Tested them on pregnant rats and watched them give birth to pups with deformed eyes.
And we're now joined by Robert Bilott. He is the attorney who wrote the book, his memoir, Exposure, Poisoned Water, Corporate Greed, and One Lawyer's 25-Year Battle Against DuPont. And he represented a diverse range of clients on a wide variety of matters involving federal, state, and local environmental law. And Robert, welcome to The Source.
Oh, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
What's your reaction to this recent action by the Environmental Protection Agency against these forever chemicals?
Well, you know, it's really historic. It's action that we have been waiting for decades. I think I first got involved in this issue about 25 years ago, trying to raise awareness of what was really a massive public health threat that was going unnoticed in this country and around the world. And it's taken a long time to get that information out. But we have finally, I think, gotten the information out to regulators, lawmakers, and the public. And what we've seen now from the US EPA, sort of the culmination of that story finally getting out. The US EPA declaring the Teflon chemical PFOA hazardous substance under the federal Superfund law, and the related chemical PFOS used in Scotchgard and firefighting foams. But also the US EPA finally setting national drinking water limits for these chemicals in drinking water. So steps being taken finally to protect millions of Americans, and I think that's going to reverberate now across the world.
The number to call in if you've got a question or a comment about these forever chemicals and our exposure to them, questions about this process, for Robert Bellott, give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So, Robert, do you think these steps that the EPA is now taking, is that going to be enough?
Well, I think they are long overdue what I would call first steps. We are finally taking action to restrict the amount of these chemicals in our drinking water, which for many years has been a really concerning issue. You know, these chemicals have been in drinking water supplies all over the country, all over the world, and really were completely unregulated. And so there really wasn't the funding or the steps out there being taken to reduce that exposure. So that's starting. We're finally also, I think, going to be providing some tools to begin trying to clean up what's already out there. But we have a long way to go. These chemicals are still being used in a variety of products. And so a lot of activities underway to try to adopt new laws and standards to try to make sure we kind of stop these at the source, stop more of them from getting out into the world, into our air, our soil, our water, into our blood. And then we're going to have to figure out, how do we get these chemicals out of the environment? How do we get them out of the soil? How do we destroy them? How do we deal with the impacts they're having on people? Yeah, these are chemicals that are being found in the blood of about 99% of the people on Earth. And they have been linked with some pretty significant health impacts. So we really have to start addressing the health consequences of what's happened for decades.
The idea that these are forever chemicals and they don't break down because of the strong bond of the carbon atoms, they accumulate in the system. So how can you have a safe level when it's cumulative?
Well, I think that's precisely why you're seeing these new drinking water guidelines coming out from the federal government being so low. You know, you have standards that have just come out for nationwide drinking water that is essentially saying if you can find them as low as about 4 parts per trillion, excuse me, that's too high. And the actual goal, the maximum contaminant level goals, have been set at 0 because they are seen, PFOA and PFOS, as human carcinogens. And they unfortunately have been found through a lot of different types of studies, a lot of different human studies that have been coming out over the years, to be having potential effects like on the immune system at very, very low exposure levels. So, there are a lot of scientists out there that have been saying we really can't necessarily find a, quote, safe, close quote, level for these chemicals.
Got to take a break. Our phone lines are open. If you've got a question or a comment about these forever chemicals, the exposure that we have, a lot of people are trying to make sense of this. So, you know, there's a lot of fear right now, and whether that's justified or what to do with that fear, we'll talk about that when we come back from the break. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues right after this.
Support for TPR comes from La Fonda on Main, honoring the authentic cuisine of interior Mexico since 1932. Open for lunch, brunch, and dinner. More information at lafondaonmain.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about forever chemicals. These are chemicals that don't break down, and they have been produced synthetic chemicals used in industries since the 1940s in our cookware, in our clothing, carpets, used in firefighting foam. Robert Bellott is the environmental attorney, and he took on DuPont, which manufactured these chemicals in West Virginia, and he beat them. It was a David versus Goliath sort of a story. But since then, we've learned a lot more about these chemicals. And now recently, the EPA has stepped in and put in for the first time limits on these chemicals. And people are waking up and realizing, holy cow, what is going on here? Do I have these things in me? And what are they doing to me? What are they doing to my family? If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 833-877-8255. Robert, there was a recent study by the U.S. Geological Survey tested the nation's drinking water and found that at least 45% of the samples had at least one or more of these forever chemicals. So if you live in an urban area or near an industrial site and you're thinking that this doesn't impact me, you think people are just, you know, being in denial?
You know, it's a shame, but what we have learned over the last several years is these chemicals weren't just used, as you mentioned, you know, in Teflon or Scotchgard and stain-resistant clothing, carpeting, fast food wrappers, et cetera. But one product in particular that they were used in for decades was a type of firefighting foam called aqueous film-forming foam, or AFFF, the type of foam that was used by pretty much almost every airport, fire station, military base, all over the country, all over the world. And how are you told to use that? You spray it out onto the ground. And unfortunately, as testing has begun outside of those areas, not surprisingly, these chemicals that were used in the foam, particularly PFOS and PFOA, have been found at fairly high concentrations all over the country and unfortunately all over the world. So it's very widespread contamination. In fact, we're representing hundreds of cities, municipalities all over the U.S., over a dozen states that are bringing claims now to try to figure out who should be paying to clean this up, because you now have water systems, utilities all over the country that are facing pretty high expense to try to now get these out of our water, to reduce them down to the levels that are now being set by the regulatory agencies. And we want to make sure, you know, the victims of that contamination aren't the ones paying the costs here. So as you can imagine, that's led to pretty widespread litigation all over the country. Some recent settlements for over about $14 billion that we've been able to recover to start getting money for these water systems to start cleaning this up. But it's going to be a long process. And unfortunately, what we've learned is this is very widespread contamination. These are chemicals that are being found even in the rain coming down all over the planet. So it's very difficult to avoid.
You point out in your memoir, Exposure, Poisoned Water, Corporate Greed, and One Lawyer's 25-Year Battle Against DuPont. And then it was also put together in Hollywood's way in the film Dark Waters, that the companies like DuPont, they knew about this, yet they continued to produce and not inform the public about these risks. Is that right?
Yeah. As you mentioned early on the show, these are chemicals that were invented a long time ago. We're talking back around the time of World War II, and have been used extensively in just a huge array of different products for many, many decades. And unfortunately, the companies making these chemicals, the folks like DuPont or 3M, were doing tests and studies internally going way back into the 60s and 70s. Finding, pretty serious concerns and risks for health and the environment. But unfortunately, covered that up and withheld that information and didn't disclose it to the public or to the scientific community, to regulators. And it took lawsuits that began in the 1990s to try that finally got that information out. And the regulatory agencies have been trying to sort of catch up now to something that had been out there and that really nobody knew about until just recently. So it's, unfortunately, there was a lot of information known and things could have been done to prevent this a long time ago, which is why now all this litigation is trying to make sure that the companies that did know this and covered it up, that they're the ones paying for this.
Let's go to a caller. We have Tom on the line. And Tom, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was just wondering if y'all know, we had Teflon on pans and scotch guard on couches and, like you said, carpet and stuff. What has been the effect on people? I mean, that's been going way back. It seemed like to the, maybe the 60s or 70s or something.
All right. And so Tom's wondering, you know, is we've been living with this stuff for 50 years or so. How do we know this is actually that bad?
Right. Well, we've got decades of studies done by the companies themselves that were making these chemicals that were showing the toxic effects of these chemicals, not only in animal studies, but in studies of their own workers. And then there have been additional studies done of exposed communities. For example, the community we were representing along the Ohio River, outside of DuPont Teflon plant, we had about 70,000 people who participated in some of the biggest human health studies ever done on any chemical that stretched over 7 years. In those studies, we're able to confirm, you know, that exposure to the chemical in the drinking water was linked with serious disease, including two types of cancer, kidney cancer and testicular cancer. And it was those studies by independent scientists that, some of the biggest ever done, that were what eventually convinced the regulatory agencies to dig into this and begin cracking down on these chemicals. And studies that have been done since then have shown even additional impacts, like on our immune system, at even lower exposure levels. So the science is pretty solid now. Showing the effects, and that's why you're seeing, you know, steps being taken by folks like the US EPA, really cracking down on exposures, and now we see that happening worldwide.
But even at the level of exposure as a consumer, you know, I'm not working in the DuPont factory, I'm not, you know, spraying this firefighting foam so it's not getting on my skin. It's in the water and it'll be in these tiny amounts. That's enough to impact me?
Well, you've got that's an active area of debate right now because, again, you're seeing, you're seeing these impacts to human health being found at very, very low exposure levels that are commonly found just among the general public, people that aren't working at the factories or having some particular big source of exposure. So that's what's really concerning the regulatory agencies and the lawmakers. In fact, there was a National Academy of Sciences report that came out about about last summer that was looking at, you know, the levels even in the general U.S. population and whether they presented any concerns, you know, for potential need for medical testing or monitoring. And that National Academy actually suggested that there might be a need, you know, to be doing monitoring and studying of folks, even at the levels being found in the general population. Because again, these chemicals are being found to have these adverse effects at very low levels. And what's particularly concerning is when we get them in us, they stay there. Our bodies really don't know how to get rid of them. So they stay there and they tend to build up over time. So even low exposures, if they occur over many years, can build up to levels of concern. And that's what's really troubling the scientific community.
Where in the body does it live? Is it in my blood, in my bones, in my fat?
Well, the two that have been studied the most, the ones that have 8 carbons attached to fluorine, what we call C8s, that you heard, you know, in that clip from the movie Dark Waters, you know, PFOA, and PFOS are the C8s that have been studied the most. Those chemicals, for example, tend to accumulate in our blood. And what happens then, unfortunately, is when they stay in the blood, they then circulate throughout the body, coating different organs and kind of, you know, it's almost like having, it's like a ticking time bomb is the analogy that's been used because it stays there circulating for many years. Some of the newer chemicals in this family that we now call PFAS, per- and polyfluoroalkylated substances, quite a mouthful. But it's any of the chemicals in this family that have this carbon fluorine bond, and there could be thousands of them in that family. Well, some of these newer chemicals in that family are being found to accumulate in different parts of the body, sometimes in different organs like the brain or different parts of the body. So it's really an active area of research right now to make sure people understand exactly how these are behaving. Because, again, they're man-made, and the body just really doesn't know how to get rid of it.
And as you have discovered, and we were learning, this was something that the companies knew about, and yet they continued with, and now we're dealing with this exposure. People are angry. Do you feel that?
Absolutely. I think you see that pretty well demonstrated in the film Dark Waters, you know, or the documentary The Devil We Know, showing what happens in communities and, you know, where you find out you've been exposed this way, and the fact that it was known that this was occurring, yet nothing was done. The frustration that folks feel when we alert the government officials, you know, it takes so long to get something done. You know, here again, I think I first sent my letter to the US EPA alerting them that these chemicals were getting into US drinking water and asking for drinking water standards. That was in 2001. And here we are 23 years later, now finally getting the first enforceable drinking water standard for these chemicals. So it's a very frustrating process. And because the chemicals were essentially unregulated throughout this whole period of time up until just very, very recently, people were forced to go into court to have to get clean water or to get this stopped. And, you know, it was an expensive, long, difficult process. So it's been a very, very long, rough battle for people who've been exposed to this for as long as they have.
DuPont did not sue over the film, but they did put out a statement saying that there are some inaccuracies and that scenes were invented out of whole cloth. Of course, this is a Hollywood production, and they have to pay attention to creating a streamlined narrative. Do you feel that the film Dark Waters is available, you know, is an accurate portrayal?
Yeah, you know, I think they did a fantastic job in taking a long, very complex issue and story, one spanning several decades, involving very complex science, a lot of legal processes and procedures back and forth, and putting it together in a way that accurately captures, what happened here in less than 2 hours. You know, and one of the reasons I wrote the book, Exposure, was to lay the facts out there so people can check for themselves. You know, here's what actually happened. And, you know, this is based on an actual true story. I mean, these are things that really transpired. The folks putting the film together, I think, did a fantastic job in sticking to the true story and incorporating as many of the actual people and places as they could as well. So I think they did a great job in, you know, what is usually a difficult process, you know, putting something like that actually happened into a film.
Right. Make me understand chemistry. That's pretty crazy that they were able to do that. So the film is available now on a lot of streaming platforms. It'll cost you about $3 or $4 to watch it. Starting on May 1st, it'll be available on Netflix. Do you think, as people watch this, it'll just add to the fury? People want to know, what can we do to protect ourselves and how did this happen to us? Robert Balot, thank you so much. Thank you for your work, and thank you for telling the story, and thank you for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure being here.
And we're going to continue discussing forever chemicals in the second half of the program, particularly how they impact women. Women are especially vulnerable to the impact of them. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
The EarthX 2024 Environmental and Sustainability Congress of Conferences is happening in Dallas, April 22nd through the 26th, bringing together all sides with one important mission: protect our planet. For info, earthx.org.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're continuing our conversation about forever chemicals and about the EPA's recent move to limit them and how this impacts us and what's in our drinking water. We're now joined by Sharon Udison. She's a staff reporter at The Hill, and she covers U.S. Western climate and policy issues. She's co-authoring a book on forever chemicals, comes out next year. She's been writing a series of stories at The Hill about fighting forever chemicals women face pervasive PFAS risk. And Sharon, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me about your reporting about how you're seeing that women are facing higher risk. What's happening?
Well, there are a number of different aspects. In that series, we started by just looking at how so many products marketed towards women, oftentimes even teenagers, just seem to contain PFAS or have in the past contained PFAS. For example, period underwear, which is becoming increasingly popular among teens, yoga apparel, often marketed towards women, all kinds of cosmetics. And then we kind of went from there to look at like how the bodies of women could particularly be showing a lot of effects of these chemicals.
And the issue of birth defects, is that also?
Well, so it's being studied. I would like to say that there's a lot of anxiety that mothers now face while pregnant, if you think about it, because scientists are studying like how PFAS can transfer to a fetus and how much PFAS can get from a mother's blood to the baby. Then they're looking at how does this affect fetal development, like what can be the possible long-term results. There are now like pretty solid links about lower birth weight effects, but the problem is that looking at lifetime effects takes a long time. If you give birth to a baby today, you might not know whether that baby is going to have cancer 30 years from now immediately. So it's very, very challenging. And I really like to bring up that maternal anxiety that really, you know, now it's yet another way for parents to be anxious. And another is in the idea of nursing, like the presence of PFAS potentially in breast milk, which has often been touted as, you know, liquid gold. But now a nursing parent has to make an impossible decision. Do I nurse my baby and potentially expose them to more PFAS? Do I use formula with potentially contaminated water? And I don't know, it's just hard enough to be up with a newborn every couple hours in the middle of the night. You know, I know that from experience. I'm a mom. But to have to also think about this added factor is just, you know, a formidable addition to what new parents are already dealing with.
Well, you know, you put people in an impossible situation when we, you know, we have all this like, well, breast milk, we know how important that is for a psychological bonding and also the impact, the benefits for your immune system and nutrition. And so, and then you say, but there's PFAS there. But you say, well, you know, in formula, you're going to be mixing with water and everything else. That's also, hey, that's got it too. And so people just throw up their hands and say, well, there's nothing we can do. And then when you say, well, my tap water has it, but then again, the bottled water has it too, and not everyone can afford
it. Who knows what's in the formula ingredient also? Like,
so it's kind of like, well, what do we do? But not everyone can afford one of these elaborate reverse osmosis water filtering system in their homes. So, you know, it's like, how are we supposed to function in that kind of a world?
That's why I mentioned the maternal anxiety, the parental anxiety of people who are living in the most contaminated communities and getting pregnant and then raising children after that. It's just, I mean, having been to a lot of these contaminated communities, as Rob Blatt said in earlier, he's a very great person to follow, a difficult person to follow, but these are real people, real communities that are experiencing this. And when you go talk to them, you see that anxiety up close.
Let's go to a caller. We have Caroline. Caroline, you're on the air.
Yes. Thank you for, once again, very, very timely and ubiquitous and hidden for all too long issue that you bring up today. Danger, actually. I saw dark water at the Santikos Bijou a few years ago and was really struck by that. But as your current guest says, the real life people that were impacted so tragically, and how long it took to get, and the relentlessness of folks like your, like Robert, to get that to the stage it is now. I want to tie that to something currently too, coming out with the EPA. And not only are they in the disaffecting in particular communities that are downstream, so to speak, or adjacent to where that was being produced, but also locally, the Guajolote Creek project that is being impacted for water over the whole aquifer recharge zone in similar ways. And the EPA report has a way of intercepting possibly a ruling that could get through and impact this whole area imminently. And perhaps you could say a bit more about that and even focus on that in upcoming programming that, and guests that that needs, that's local, this is global, but need some groundswell to take the anger and the awareness into action too. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Caroline. So we're talking about a development where they're looking for the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality permitting to allow them to do wastewater treatment. And they didn't have to, under the TCEQ, consider these forever chemicals because the EPA had at that time not posted this as a hazardous chemical. But now that has changed, and people are looking at this situation as something that may save the San Antonio aquifer from more of this contamination, and also area wells that people and their land that they have in this area. But to that point, Sharon, if you could talk about, this is a global issue, it's a national issue, state issue, and it is a hyper-local issue as well.
Yes, I agree with that. And it is great that there are finally now these regulations, but it will take time before you actually see action in terms of, so you were just talking about the hazardous chemical designations, but in terms of the drinking water limits, for example, you know, public water systems will need to monitor for PFAS for the next 3 years, but then if they are surpassing the levels, then they will still have 5 years from now to implement solutions. So, I mean, yeah, it's great that it's happened now, but we do need to wait and see what action is going to occur. And honestly, I took a look at the San Antonio area, even though I'm in Colorado, and there is actually like a lot of similarities between the San Antonio area and the area of Colorado that I looked at a lot, because surrounded by Air Force bases. And Rob mentioned earlier the AFFF foam, the firefighting foam that was released, you know, for decades by air bases. And there are quite high levels of PFAS all around, basically, like I would say, kind of the perimeter of San Antonio. And, you know, that stuff has probably leached into the groundwater for a long time. The public water system, their levels are a bit better. But, you know, if you have private wells, I don't actually know the layout of San Antonio because I've never been there, unfortunately. But if there are private wells in those areas, then that could be something to think about. So that's just a local example, like you said, of a global problem.
Right. Well, we've had, like you said, these military bases here. There's been reports of underwater plumes of of chemicals, because, you know, the military would dump chemicals. And then they would dump these firefighting foams frequently. Apparently, they would have to cycle them even if they hadn't been used, or they would use them in training quite a bit. So even though there weren't a lot of these fires that they may have been trying to put out, but they were still using this product quite a bit. And it does impact a person on skin contact. You don't have to actually consume it. So there's been a lot of curiosity, a lot of outrage over the years, people wondering what has happened. And, you know, we have things like the Fort Lejeune, you know, we see those commercials all the time. People wondering, like, well, what about here? And what do I need to know? And, you know, and knowledge is power. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of that available right now. So we're going to take a break. We're going to come back. Our phone lines are open. You got a question or comment about these forever chemicals? How do we protect ourselves? How do we put this in context so we can deal with it and not be overwhelmed or freaked out or scared? 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues after this quick break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're speaking with Sharon Budison. She is a reporter, journalist at The Hill. She's written a series, and she continues to write it, about the forever chemicals. Women face pervasive risk from them, and she is co-authoring a book on this issue that comes out in 2025. Got a question? Give us a call, 833-877-8255. Let's listen to one of our voicemails.
I do have a comment or some concerns with regards to the wastewater that will be coming off the Guajolote Ranch. My family's land is the first point of entry into where the water will be coming in. We have concerns about not only the environmental impact, wildlife out here, they'll be exposed to that. Our children and grandkids, you know, when the springs are open, they play in the river or the creek. They'll no longer be able to do that. In addition to that, the drinking water is a huge concern for myself and multiple family members that live along the creek bed, simply because either the proximity to the creek or the depth of our wells. Some of us live a quarter mile back from the creek. Some of us live right on the creek, but our wells are not very deep. So we don't have that filtration, you know, when you get down to that deeper level aquifer. Not sure that our state government body is really looking at protecting us as Texans. Hopefully this won't pass, but I just wanted to share the thoughts and concerns coming off of Sam's Ranch. Thank you.
All right. So Sharon, I know you can't address these concerns precisely, and I appreciate the fact that you did look at the what you could online about San Antonio's situation here. But what can you tell people about their wells if they're concerned about having PFAS and other forever chemicals? What can they do?
I mean, the wells themselves
Drinking well water.
They are really something to be concerned about. Was in Maine looking at, there's a lot of sludge spread on the agricultural fields in Maine. That's historic. It's not happening anymore. But as we know, these chemicals are forever. And when they're in sludge, they're in fields and they're seeping in to the drinking water wells, because a lot of people in Maine have private drinking water wells. And federal regulation doesn't really cover private drinking water wells in terms of the Safe Drinking Water Act. But luckily, the state of Maine, at least, is providing a lot of affected people with in-home treatment systems. And so that's really what people can do. But as you said, those are expensive. And if the state of Texas is not going to do that, then that's going to be a financial burden that people are going to have to take upon themselves, which I know that's a really hard decision. Like, are you going to choose to pay for clean drinking water, or are you going to, you know, choose to have a doctor's appointment or a car or whatever? Like, I mean, that is really a difficult choice to make. And those are going to be, unfortunately, state level choices.
Do you know if they use these PFAS and other forever chemicals and things like fracking, for fracking? They use a lot of chemicals for fracking.
There is some research about the presence in frack fluid, but I'm not sure, like, not being from Texas, I don't know how well that is actually contained. That probably depends on the project, but yes, there have been studies about this, unfortunately.
Now, this EPA regulation that's now put into effect, they're only targeting, I think, 6 specific chemicals, mm-hmm. But there are thousands of these. Will the, just by filtering out these specific 6 ones, also kind of encapture everything else?
It depends which type of filtration that you're using, unfortunately. There are 3 main different types in terms of municipal water treatment. There's I'll just say the names of them really quickly: granular activated carbon, reverse osmosis, and ion exchange. The first two, there are like home systems, but I mean, none of them are going to be perfect for getting out every single type of PFAS. From what I've heard, reverse osmosis gets out kind of the most. But yeah, that's a really good point to make, that, you know, we're currently focusing on 6, but some people say there are as many as 15,000 types of PFAS. And yeah, these systems are very expensive for the average consumer to have in their house.
Let's go to another voicemail and give a listen.
Yes, my name is Stuart. According to a paper that was presented at the Geological Society of America in 2021, these chemicals are already in our aquifer. They are ubiquitous. They are everywhere. And yet the state permits the emplacement of on-site wastewater treatment facilities that minimally treat the water. This is only going to exacerbate the problem and make things worse. An example is the Guajolote development that's proposed on the recharge zone for the Trinity Aquifer, which is a contributing zone for the Edwards Aquifer. We have to stop doing these on-site treatment plants. There should be proper sewage treatment plants. And the new EPA finding indicates quite clearly that we need to keep these chemicals out of our water and out of our systems. Thank you. Bye.
All right. So I'm glad we played that, and I wanted to hear that, and I wanted the public to hear that. But it seems to be, you know, just more concern about this one particular development, mm-hmm. and what's happening to the water there. But I want to step back and get back to what you have been writing, Sharon, at The Hill, about how women face pervasive risk from these PFAS. And is that because, you know, women are more likely to be exposed to these chemicals, like you said, in makeup and other products?
Yeah, I would say that's one reason. Just because those things are so marketed, it's not like a man can't use all those things, but they're very much marketed towards women. But I did want to bring up, there's actually one benefit of being a woman in this situation, in that there is the benefit of having a menstrual cycle, because several studies have now shown that menstruation is a really important route of elimination for many PFAS, because they build up in your blood. And there was one study that even showed a 30% discrepancy between male and female PFAS blood levels, like when among menstruating women, I mean. So that was just an interesting and, I guess, like a positive finding for women in a way. I've also read that there's studies in the British island of Jersey. They're testing out the idea of phlebotomy, basically having firefighters go, you know, donate blood without donating it, and seeing how that, like, affects their PFAS levels.
You mean like bloodletting, like with leeches and things, like the old days?
Exactly, yeah. So they're actually looking at that to see if that's a good elimination route. So.
But if so, well, people do donate blood, and so when they do that, are they, I guess they're sharing also the PFAS. Does that blood need to be screened?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe it does. I don't think it is right now, but that's a good point, you know, and that's a moral decision you're making if, like, you want to go and give blood and you know you have high PFAS levels. Like, I mean, that's kind of up to you right now.
So as you're writing this book, and you said your deadline is in 2 weeks, so thank you for some of your precious time right now. I mean, what is it that you want people to know? How are we supposed to navigate a world where everywhere we turn is another threat, whether it be, microplastics, mm-hmm. We're eating a credit card every week, apparently. The bottled water is not any better than the tap water. As a matter of fact, the tap water could be better because at least the tap water is regulated. What do you want people to know?
Well, we don't want people to have complete despair, first of all, but we do want to share the narratives of, like I said, various communities throughout the country who have been affected by this in real ways. You know, there are areas where there has been tons of cancer, tons of death, and it's just to get to know those people and put faces on this problem, I think, is really important. However, I also want to say that there are solutions underway. They will take a long time to unfold, but some of the ones you mentioned or we mentioned earlier is water treatment, and there are technologies that now remove the PFAS from the water. Then, though, the question remains, what do you do with the PFAS that's removed? It's still there. It's still going to be somebody else's problem, in a landfill, an incinerator, et cetera. However, there are now really brilliant scientists working on ways to actually degrade the PFAS, to like break it apart, these super strongly bonded, as Rob Ballad was talking about earlier, compounds. They now have ways to actually split them apart, and it's starting to unroll on a commercial scale. I don't think it will be cheap, but in that way, there is some hope. And, even the people in all of these communities that I've visited, they've echoed some of that sentiment as well. They are feeling a little hopeful that although it's way too late, there is finally, national attention to this problem.
Also need to make aware that there's been some reporting that home filters that you might buy at the store for water, they may have a claim that they can mm-hmm. reduce PFAS on its outer packaging, but that may not actually be true. So I wouldn't count on that for being, your savior in this situation. Have you found that? Is that true?
Yeah, I would agree with that as well. What I have heard in general is that like your standard, not granular activated carbon filters, but the standard carbon filtration that might be in a device might take out some PFAS, but nobody really knows how much. So, yeah, I would not rely on those claims either.
All right. Sharon Udison, thank you so much. The reporter at The Hill, her series is on women face pervasive risk from PFAS, and she's also finishing a book. The days are counting down for your deadline. I appreciate you coming on board talking about that. Forever Chemicals comes out in 2025. Sharon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thank you for joining us.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.